a pity you saw it." I did not answer. I was watching for Vel, who was getting slowly to his feet. He sat down heavily on the sofa and put his handkerchief to his face.
"Get me a drink," he said. "Get me a drink."
Maxim looked at Frank. Frank went out of the room. None of us spoke. In a moment Frank came back with a whiskey and soda on a tray. He mixed some in a glass and gave it to Favelle. Favelle drank it greedily like an animal. There was something sensual and horrible the way he put his mouth to the glass. His lips folded upon the glass in a peculiar way. There was a dark red patch on his jaw where Maxim had hit him. Maxim had turned his back on him again and had returned to the window. I glanced at Colonel Julian and saw that he was looking at Maxim. His gaze was curious, intent. My heart began beating very quickly. Why did Colonel Julian look at Maxim in that way? Did it mean that he was beginning to wonder, to suspect? Maxim did not see. He was watching the rain. It fell straight and steady as before. The sound filled the room. Favell finished his whiskey and soda and put the glass back on the table beside the sofa. He was breathing heavily. He did not look at any of us. He was staring straight in front of him at the floor. The telephone began ringing in the little room. It struck a shrill, discordant note. Frank went to answer it. He came back at once and looked at Colonel Julian. "It's your daughter," he said. "They want to know if they are to keep dinner back." Colonel Julian waved his hand impatiently. "Tell them to start," he said. "Tell them I don't know when I shall be back." He glanced at his watch. "Fancy ringing up," he muttered. "What a moment to choose." Frank went back into the little room to give the message. I thought of the daughter at the other end of the telephone. It would be the one who played golf. I could imagine her calling to her sister. "Dad says we're to start. What on earth can he be doing? The steak will be like leather." Their little household disorganized because of us, their evening routine upset. All these foolish, inconsequent threads hanging upon one another because Maxim had killed Rebecca. I looked at Frank. His face was pale and set. "I heard Robert coming back with the car," he said to Colonel Julian. "The window in there looks onto the drive." He went out of the library to the hall. Favell had lifted his head when he spoke. Then he got to his feet once more and stood looking towards the door. There was a queer, ugly smile on his face. The door opened and Frank came in. He turned and spoke to someone in the hall outside. "All right, Ben," he said quietly. "Mr. De Winter wants to give you some cigarettes. There's nothing to be frightened of." Ben stepped awkwardly into the room. He had his sou'wester in his hands. He looked odd and naked without his hat. I realized for the first time that his head was shaved all over, and he had no hair. He looked different. Dreadful. The light seemed to daze him. He glanced foolishly round the room, blinking his small eyes. He caught sight of me, and I gave him a weak, rather tremulous smile. I don't know if he recognized me or not. He just blinked his eyes. Then Favell walked slowly towards him and stood in front of him.
"Hello," he said. "How's life treated you since we last met?"
Ben stared at him. There was no recognition on his face. He did not answer.
"Well," said Favell, "you know who I am, don't you?"
Ben went on twisting his sou'wester.
"Eh?" he said.
"Have a cigarette," said Favell, handing him the box. Ben glanced at Maxim and Frank.
"All right," said Maxim. "Take as many as you like."
Ben took four and stuck two behind each ear. Then he stood twisting his cap again.
"You know who I am, don't you?" repeated Favell.
Still Ben did not answer. Colonel Julian walked across to him.
"You shall go home in a few moments, Ben," he said. "No one is going to hurt you. We just want you to answer one or two questions. You know Mr. Favell, don't you?"
This time Ben shook his head.
"I never seen," he said.
"Don't be a bloody fool," said Favell roughly. "You know you've seen me. You've seen me go to the cottage on the beach, Mrs. De Winter's cottage. You've seen me there, haven't you?"
"No," said Ben. "I never see no one."
"You damned half-witted liar," said Favell. "Are you going to stand there and say you never saw me last year walk through those woods with Mrs. De Winter and go into the cottage? Didn't we catch you once peering at us from the window?"
"Eh?" said Ben.
"A convincing witness," said Colonel Julian sarcastically. Favell swung round on him.
"It's a put-up job," he said. "Someone has got at this idiot and bribed him, too." I tell you, he's seen me scores of times. Here, will this make you remember?
He fumbled in his hip pocket and brought out a note case. He flourished a pound note in front of Ben.
Now do you remember me? He said.
Ben shook his head.
I never seen un, he said.
And then he took hold of Frank's arm.
Has he come here to take me to the asylum? He said.
No, said Frank. No, of course not, Ben.
I don't want to go to the asylum, said Ben. Them cruel to folk in there. I want to stay home. I done nothing.
That's all right, Ben, said Colonel Julian. No one's going to put you in the asylum.
Are you quite sure you've never seen this man before?
No, said Ben. I never seen un.
You remember Mrs. De Winter, don't you? Said Colonel Julian.
Ben glanced doubtfully towards me.
No, said Colonel Julian gently. Not this lady, the other lady who used to go to the cottage.
Eh? Said Ben.
You remember the lady who had the boat? Ben blinked his eyes.
She's gone, he said.
Yes, we know that, said Colonel Julian. She used to sail the boat, didn't she? Were you on the beach when she sailed the boat the last time?
One evening, over 12 months ago, when she didn't come back again.
Ben twisted his sou'wester. He glanced at Frank, and then at Maxim.
Eh?
He said.
You were there, weren't you? Said Favell, leaning forward. You saw Mrs. De Winter come down to the cottage, and presently you saw Mr. De Winter, too. He went into the cottage after her. What happened then? Go on. What happened?
Ben shrank back against the wall.
I see nothing, he said. I want to stay home. I'm not going to the asylum. I never seen you, never before. I never seen you and she in the woods.
He began to blubber like a child.
You crazy little rat, said Favell slowly. You bloody crazy little rat.
Ben was wiping his eyes with the sleeve of his coat.
Your witness does not seem to have helped you, said Colonel Julian. The performance has been rather a waste of time, hasn't it? Do you want to ask him anything else?
It's a plot, shouted Favell. A plot against me. You're all in it, every one of you. Someone's paid this half-wit, I tell you. Paid him to tell a string of dirty lies.
I think Ben might be allowed to go home, said Colonel Julian.
All right, Ben, said Maxim. Robert shall take you back, and no one will put you in the asylum. Don't be afraid. Tell Robert to find him something in the kitchen, he added to Frank. Some cold meat, whatever he fancies. Payment for services rendered, eh? Said Favell. He's done a good day's work for you, Max, hasn't he?
Frank took Ben out of the room. Colonel Julian glanced at Maxim.
The fellow appeared to be scared stiff, he said. He was shaking like a leaf. I was watching him. He's never been ill-treated, has he?
No, said Maxim. He's perfectly harmless, and I've always let him have the run of the place.
He's been frightened at some time, said Colonel Julian. He was showing the whites of his eyes, just like a dog does when you're going to whip him.
Well, why didn't you, said Favell. He'd have remembered me all right if you'd whipped him. Oh, no. He's going to be given a good supper for his work tonight. Ben's not going to be whipped.
He has not helped your case, has he? Said Colonel Julian quietly. We're still where we were. You can't produce one shred of evidence against De Winter, and you know it. The very motive you gave won't stand the test. In a court of law, Favell, you wouldn't have a leg to stand on. You say you were Mrs. De Winter's prospective husband, and that you held clandestine meetings with her in that cottage on the beach. Even the poor idiot we have just had in this room swears he never saw you. You can't even prove your own story, can you?
Can't I? Said Favell.
I saw him smile. He came across to the fireplace and rang the bell.
"What are you doing?"
said Colonel Julian.
"Wait a moment and you'll see," said Favell.
I guessed already what was going to happen. Frith answered the bell.
"Ask Mrs. Danvers to come here," said Favell.
Frith glanced at Maxim. Maxim nodded shortly. Frith went out of the room. "Isn't Mrs. Danvers the housekeeper?" said Colonel Julian.
"She was also Rebecca's personal friend," said Favell. She was with her for years before she married, and practically brought her up. You're going to find Danny a very different sort of witness to Ben.
Frank came back into the room.
Packed Ben off to bed, said Favell. Given him his supper and told him he was a good boy. This time it won't be quite so easy for the trade union.
"'Mrs. Danvers is coming down,' said Colonel Julian. "'Favell seems to think he will get something out of her.' Frank glanced quickly at Maxim. Colonel Julian saw the glance. I saw his lips tighten. I did not like it. No, I did not like it. I began biting my nails. We all waited, watching the door, and Mrs. Danvers came into the room. Perhaps it was because I had generally seen her alone, and beside me she had seemed tall and gaunt. But she looked shrunken now in size, more wizened, and I noticed she had to look up to Favell and to Frank and Maxim. She stood by the door, her hands folded in front of her, looking from one to the other of us. "'Good evening, Mrs. Danvers,' said Colonel Julian. "'Good evening, sir,' she said. Her voice was that old, dead, mechanical one I had heard so often. "'First of all, Mrs. Danvers, I want to ask you a question,' said Colonel Julian. "'And the question is this. "'Were you aware of the relationship between the late Mrs. de Winter and Mr. Favell here?'
"'They were first cousins,' said Mrs. Danvers.
"'I was not referring to blood relationship, Mrs. Danvers,' said Colonel Julian. "'I mean something closer than that.'
"'I'm afraid I don't understand, sir,' said Mrs. Danvers.
"'Oh, come off it, Danny,' said Favell. "'You know damn well what he's driving at. "'I've told Colonel Julian already, but he doesn't seem to believe me. "'Rebecca and I had lived together off and on for years, hadn't we? "'She was in love with me, wasn't she?'
"'To my surprise, Mrs. Danvers considered him a moment without speaking.' And there was something of scorn in the glance she gave him.
"'She was not,' she said.
"'Listen here, you old fool,' began Favell,
but Mrs. Danvers cut him short. "'She was not in love with you, or with Mr. de Winter. "'She was not in love with anyone. "'She despised all men. "'She was above all that.' Favell flushed angrily.
"'Listen here. Didn't she come down the path through the woods to meet me, night after night? "'Didn't you wait up for her? "'Didn't she spend the weekends with me in London?'
"'Well,' said Mrs. Danvers with sudden passion,
"'and what if she did? "'She had a right to amuse herself, hadn't she? "'Lovemaking was a game with her, only a game. "'She told me so. "'She did it because it made her laugh. "'It made her laugh, I tell you. "'She laughed at you like she did at the rest. "'I've known her come back and sit upstairs in her bed "'and rock with laughter at the lot of you.'
"'There was something horrible in the sudden torrent of words. "'Something horrible and unexpected. "'It revolted me.' "'Even though I knew.' "'Maxim had gone very white. "'Favell stared at her blankly, as though he had not understood. "'Colonel Julian tugged at his small moustache. "'No one said anything for a few minutes, "'and there was no sound but that inevitable falling rain. "'Then Mrs. Danvers began to cry. "'She cried like she had done that morning in the bedroom. "'I could not look at her. "'I had to turn away. "'No one said anything.' There were just the two sounds in the room, the falling rain and Mrs. Danvers crying. It made me want to scream. I wanted to run out of the room and scream and scream. No one moved towards her to say anything or to help her. She went on crying. Then at last, it seemed eternity, she began to control herself. Little by little the crying ceased. She stood quite still, her face working, her hands clutching the black stuff of her frock. At last she was silent again. Then Colonel Julian spoke quietly, slowly. "'Mrs. Danvers,' he said, "'can you think of any reason, however remote, "'why Mrs. de Winter should have taken her own life?' "'Mrs. Danvers swallowed. "'She went on clutching at her frock. "'She shook her head. "'No,' she said. "'No.'
"'There. You see?' Favell said swiftly. "'It's impossible. She knows that as well as I do. I've told you already.'
"'Be quiet, will you?' said Colonel Julian. "'Give Mrs. Danvers time to think. We all of us agree that on the face of it, the thing's absurd, out of the question. I'm not disputing the truth or veracity of that note of yours. It's plain for us to see. She wrote you that note sometime during those hours she spent in London. There was something she wanted to tell you.' It's just possible that if we knew what that something was, we might have the answer to the whole appalling problem. Let Mrs. Danvers read the note. She may be able to throw light on it.
Favell shrugged his shoulders. He felt in his pocket for the note and threw it on the floor at Mrs. Danvers' feet. She stooped and picked it up. We watched her lips move as she read the words. She read it twice. Then she shook her head. "It's no use," she said. I don't know what she meant. If there was something important she had to tell Mr. Jack, she would have told me first.
You never saw her that night?
No, I was out. I was spending the afternoon and evening in Kerith. I shall never forgive myself for that. Never till my dying day.
Then you know of nothing on her mind. You can't suggest a solution, Mrs. Danvers. Those words, I have something to tell you, do not convey anything to you at all.
No, she answered. No, sir, nothing at all.
Does anybody know how she spent that day in London?
Nobody answered. Maxim shook his head. Favell swore under his breath.
Look here. She left that note at my flat. 3 in the afternoon, he said. The porter saw her. She must have driven down here straight after that and gone like the wind, too.
Mrs. De Winter had a hair appointment from 12 until 1:30, said Mrs. Danvers. I remember that because I had to telephone through to London from here earlier in the week and book it for her. I remember doing it. 12 to 1:30. She always lunched at her club after a hair appointment so that she could leave the pins in her hair. It's almost certain she lunched there that day.
Say it took her 30 minutes to have lunch. What was she doing from 2 until 3?
We ought to verify that, said Colonel Julian.
Oh, Christ Jesus, who the hell cares what she was doing, shouted Favell. She didn't kill herself. That's the only thing that matters, isn't it?
I've got her engagement diary locked in my room, said Mrs. Danvers slowly. I kept all those things. Mr. De Winter never asked me for them. It's just possible she may have noted down her appointments for that day. She was methodical in that way. She used to put everything down and then tick the items off with a cross. If you think it would be helpful, I'll go and fetch the diary.
"Well, De Winter," said Colonel Julian, "what do you say? Do you mind us seeing this diary?"
"Of course not," said Maxim. "Why on earth should I?"
Once again I saw Colonel Julian give him that swift, curious glance, and this time Frank noticed it. I saw Frank look at Maxim, too, and then back again to me. This time it was I who got up and went towards the window. It seemed to me that it was no longer raining quite so hard. The fury was spent. The rain that was falling now had a quieter, softer note. The grey light of evening had come into the sky. The lawns were dark and drenched with the heavy rain, and the trees had a shrouded, humped appearance. I could hear the housemaid overhead drawing the curtains for the night, shutting down the windows that had not been closed already. The little routine of the day going on inevitably, as it had always done. The curtains drawn, shoes taken down to be cleaned, the towel laid out on the chair in the bathroom, and the water run for my bath. Beds turned down, slippers put beneath a chair. And here were we, in the library, none of us speaking, knowing in our hearts that Maxim was standing trial here for his life. I turned round when I heard the soft closing of the door. It was Mrs. Danvers. She had come back again with the diary in her hand. "I was right," she said quietly. She had marked down the engagements, as I said she would. Here they are on the date she died. She opened the diary. A small red leather book. She gave it to Colonel Julian. Once more he brought his spectacles from his case. There was a long pause while he glanced down the page. It seemed to me then that there was something about that particular moment, while he looked at the page of the diary and we stood waiting, that frightened me more than anything that had happened that evening. I dug my nails in my hands. I could not look at Maxim. Surely Colonel Julian must hear my heart beating and thumping in my breast. "Ah," he said. His finger was in the middle of the page. "Something is going to happen," I thought. "Something terrible is going to happen."
"Yes," he said. "Yes, here it is. Hair at 12, as Mrs. Danvers said, and a cross beside it. She kept her appointment then. Lunch at the club, and a cross beside that. What have we here, though?"
"Baker, 2 o'clock.
"Who is Baker?"
He looked at Maxim. Maxim shook his head, then at Mrs. Danvers.
"Baker?" repeated Mrs. Danvers. "She knew no one called Baker. I've never heard the name before."
"Well, here it is," said Colonel Julian, handing her the diary. "You can see for yourself. Baker. And she's put a great cross beside it, as though she wanted to break the pencil. She evidently saw this Baker, whoever he may have been."
Mrs. Danvers was staring at the name written in the diary, and the black cross beside it. "Baker," she said. "Baker. I believe if we knew who Baker was, we'd be getting to the bottom of the whole business," said Colonel Julian. "She wasn't in the hands of moneylenders, was she?" Mrs. Danvers looked at him with scorn. "Mrs. De Winter," she said.
"Well, blackmailers, perhaps," said Colonel Julian, with a glance at Favell. Mrs. Danvers shook her head.
"Baker," she repeated. "Baker."
"She had no enemy, no one who had ever threatened her, no one she was afraid of."
"Mrs. De Winter afraid," said Mrs. Danvers. "She was afraid of nothing and no one. There was only one thing ever worried her, and that was the idea of getting old, of illness, of dying in her bed. She has said to me a score of times, 'When I go, Danny, I want to go quickly, like the snuffing out of a candle.' That used to be the only thing that consoled me after she died. They say drowning is painless, don't they?" She looked searchingly at Colonel Julian. He did not answer. He hesitated, tugging at his moustache. I saw him throw another glance at Maxim.
"What the hell's the use of all this?" said Favell, coming forward. "We're streaking away from the point the whole bloody time. Who cares about this Baker fellow? What's he got to do with it? It was probably some damn merchant who sold stockings or face cream. If he had been anyone important, Danny here would know him. Rebecca had no secrets from Danny."
But I was watching Mrs. Danvers. She had the book in her hands and was turning the leaves. Suddenly she gave an exclamation. "There's something here," she said, "right at the back among the telephone numbers, Baker. And there's a number beside it, 0488. But there is no exchange."
"Brilliant, Danny," said Favell. "Becoming quite a sleuth in your old age, aren't you? But you're just 12 months too late. If you'd done this a year ago, there might have been some use in it."
"That's his number, all right," said Colonel Julian. 0488, and the name Baker beside it. Why didn't she put the exchange?"
"Try every exchange in London," jeered Favell. "It will take you through the night, but we don't mind. Max doesn't care if his telephone bill is £100, do you, Max? You want to play for time, and so should I, if I were in your shoes."
"There is a mark beside the number, but it might mean anything," said Colonel Julian. "Take a look at it, Mrs. Danvers. Could it possibly be an M?"
Mrs. Danvers took the diary in her hands again. "It might be," she said doubtfully. "It's not like her usual M, but she may have scribbled it in a hurry. Yes, it might be M."
"Mayfair 0488, said Favell. "What a genius! What a brain!"
"Well," said Maxim, lighting his first cigarette, "something had better be done about it. Frank, go through and ask the exchange for Mayfair 0488.
The nagging pain was strong beneath my heart. I stood quite still, my hands by my side. Maxim did not look at me.
"Go on, Frank," he said. "What are you waiting for?"
Frank went through to the little room beyond. We waited while he called the exchange. In a moment he was back again. "They're going to ring me," he said quietly. Colonel Julian clasped his hands behind his back and began walking up and down the room. No one said anything. After about 4 minutes, the telephone rang shrill and insistent, that irritating, monotonous note of a long-distance call. Frank went through to answer it. "Is that Mayfair 0488, he said. "Can you tell me if anyone of the name of Baker lives there?" "Oh, I see. I'm so sorry. Yes, I must have got the wrong number. Thank you very much." The little click as he replaced the receiver. Then he came back into the room. "Someone called Lady Eastley lives at Mayfair 0488. It's an address in Grosvenor Street. They've never heard of Baker." Favell gave a great cackle of laughter.
"The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, they all jumped out of a rotten potato," he said. "Carry on, Detective Number One. What's the next exchange on the list?"
"Try museum," said Mrs. Danvers.
Frank glanced at Maxim.
"Go ahead," said Maxim.
The farce was repeated all over again. Colonel Julian repeated his walk up and down the room. Another 5 minutes went by, and the telephone rang again. Frank went to answer it. He left the door wide open. I could see him lean down to the table where the telephone stood and bend to the mouthpiece. "Hello, is that Museum 0488? Can you tell me if anyone of the name of Baker lives there?" "Oh, who is that speaking?" "A night porter." "Yes?" "Yes, I understand. Not offices." No, of course. Can you give me the address?" "Yes, it's rather important." He paused. He called to us over his shoulder. "I think we've got him," he said. "Oh, God, don't let it be true. Don't let Baker be found. Please, God, make Baker be dead." I knew who Baker was. I had known all along. I watched Frank through the door. I watched him lean forward suddenly, reach for a pencil and a piece of paper. "Hello? Yes, I'm still here. Could you spell it?" "Thank you. Thank you very much. Good night." He came back into the room, the piece of paper in his hands. Frank, who loved Maxim, who did not know that the piece of paper he held was the one shred of evidence that was worth a damn in the whole nightmare of our evening, and that by producing it, he could destroy Maxim as well and truly as though he had a dagger in his hand and stabbed him in the back. "It was the night porter from an address in Bloomsbury," he said. "There are no residents there at all. The place is used during the day as a doctor's consulting rooms. Apparently, Baker's given up practice and left 6 months ago. But we can get hold of him, all right. The night porter gave me his address. I wrote it down on this piece of paper." Chapter 25. It was then that Maxim looked at me. He looked at me for the first time that evening, and in his eyes I read a message of farewell. It was as though he leant against the side of a ship, and I stood below him on the quay. There would be other people touching his shoulder and touching mine, but we would not see them, nor would we speak or call to one another, for the wind and the distance would carry away the sound of our voices. But I should see his eyes, and he would see mine, before the ship drew away from the side of the quay. Favelle, Mrs. Danvers, Colonel Julian, Frank with the slip of paper in his hands. They were all forgotten at this moment. It was hours, inviolate, a fraction of time suspended between 2 seconds. And then he turned away and held out his hand to Frank. "Well done," he said. "What's the address?" "Somewhere near Barnet, north of London," said Frank, giving him the paper. "But it's not on the telephone. We can't ring him up." "Satisfactory work, Crawley," said Colonel Julian. "And from you too, Mrs. Danvers. Can you throw any light on the matter now?" Mrs. Danvers shook her head. Mrs. de Winter never needed a doctor. Like all strong people, she despised them. We only had Dr. Phillips from Kerith here once, that time she sprained her wrist. I've never heard her speak of this Dr. Baker. She never mentioned his name to me. "I tell you, the fellow was a face-cream mixer," said Favelle. "What the hell does it matter who he was? If there was anything to it, Danny would know. I tell you, it's some fool fellow who had discovered a new way of bleaching the hair or whitening the skin, and Rebecca had probably got the address from her hairdresser that morning and went along after lunch out of curiosity."
"No," said Frank. "I think you're wrong there. Baker wasn't a quack. The night porter at Museum 0488 told me he was a very well-known woman specialist."
"Hmm," said Colonel Julian, pulling at his moustache. "There must have been something wrong with her after all. It seems very curious that she did not say a word to anybody, not even to you, Mrs. Danvers."
"She was too thin," said Favelle. "I told her about it, but she only laughed, said it suited her. Banting, I suppose, like all these women. Perhaps she went to this chap Baker for a diet sheet."
"You think that's possible, Mrs. Danvers?" asked Colonel Julian. Mrs. Danvers shook her head slowly. She seemed dazed, bewildered by this sudden news about Baker.
I can't understand it, she said. I don't know what it means. Baker. A Dr. Baker. Why didn't she tell me? Why did she keep it from me? She told me everything.
Perhaps she didn't want to worry you, said Colonel Julian. No doubt she made an appointment with him and saw him, and then when she came down that night she was going to have told you all about it.
And the note to Mr. Jack, said Mrs. Danvers suddenly. That note to Mr. Jack. I have something to tell you. I must see you. She was going to tell him, too.
That's true, said Favell slowly. We were forgetting the note.
Once more he pulled it out of his pocket and read it to us aloud.
I've got something to tell you, and I want to see you as soon as possible. Rebecca.
Of course, there's no doubt about it, said Colonel Julian, turning to Maxim. I wouldn't mind betting £1,000 on it. She was going to tell Favell the result of that interview with this Dr. Baker.
I believe you're right, after all, said Favell. The note and that appointment seem to hang together. But what the hell was it all about? That's what I want to know. What was the matter with her?
The truth screamed in their faces, and they did not see. They all stood there, staring at one another, and they did not understand. I dared not look at them. I dared not move, lest I betray my knowledge. Maxim said nothing. He had gone back to the window and was looking out into the garden that was hushed and dark and still. The rain had ceased at last, but the spots fell from the dripping leaves and from the gutter above the window.
It ought to be quite easy to verify, said Frank. Here is the doctor's present address. I can write him a letter and ask him if he remembers an appointment last year with Mrs. De Winter.
I don't know if he would take any notice of it, said Colonel Julian. There is so much of this etiquette in the medical profession. Every case is confidential, you know. The only way to get anything out of him would be to get De Winter to see him privately and explain the circumstances. What do you say, De Winter?
Maxim turned round from the window.
I'm ready to do whatever you care to suggest, he said quietly.
Anything for time, eh? Said Favell. A lot can be done in 24 hours, can't it? Trains can be caught, ships can sail, aeroplanes can fly.
I saw Mrs. Danvers look sharply from Favell to Maxim, and I realized then, for the first time, that Mrs. Danvers had not known about Favell's accusation. At last she was beginning to understand. I could tell from the expression on her face. There was doubt written on it, then wonder and hatred mixed, and then conviction. Once again those lean, long hands of hers clutched convulsively at her dress, and she passed her tongue over her lips. She went on staring at Maxim. She never took her eyes away from Maxim. It's too late, I thought. She can't do anything to us now. The harm is done. It does not matter what she says to us now or what she does. The harm is done. She can't hurt us any more. Maxim did not notice her, or if he did, he gave no sign. He was talking to Colonel Julian.
What do you suggest, he said. Shall I go up in the morning, drive to this address at Barnet? I can wire Baker to expect me.
He's not going alone, said Favell with a short laugh. I have a right to insist on that, haven't I? Send him up with Inspector Welch, and I won't object.
If only Mrs. Danvers would take her eyes away from Maxim. Frank had seen her now. He was watching her, puzzled, anxious. I saw him glance once more at the slip of paper in his hands, on which he had written Dr. Baker's address. Then he, too, glanced at Maxim. I believe then that some faint idea of the truth began to force itself to his conscience, for he went very white and put the paper down on the table.
"I don't think there is any necessity to bring Inspector Welch into the affair, yet," said Colonel Julian.
His voice was different, harder. I did not like the way he used the word "yet." Why must he use it at all? I did not like it.
If I go with De Winter and stay with him the whole time and bring him back, will that satisfy you? He said.
Favell looked at Maxim, and then at Colonel Julian. The expression on his face was ugly, calculating, and there was something of triumph, too, in his light blue eyes.
Yes, he said slowly, yes, I suppose so. But for safety's sake, do you mind if I come with you too?
No, said Colonel Julian. Unfortunately, I think you have the right to ask that.
But if you do come, I have the right to insist on your being sober.
You needn't worry about that, said Favell, beginning to smile. I'll be sober, all right. Sober as the judge will be when he sentences Max in 3 months' time. I rather think this Dr. Baker is going to prove my case after all.
He looked around at each one of us and began to laugh. I think he, too, had understood at last the significance of that visit to the doctor.
Well, he said, what time are we going to start in the morning?
Colonel Julian looked at Maxim.
How early can you be ready?
Any time you say, said Maxim.
9 o'clock?
9 o'clock, said Maxim.
How do we know he won't do a bolt in the night, said Favell. He's only to cut round to the garage and get his car.
Is my word enough for you, said Maxim, turning to Colonel Julian. And for the first time Colonel Julian hesitated. I saw him glance at Frank, and a flush came over Maxim's face. I saw the little pulse beating on his forehead.
Mrs. Danvers, he said slowly,
when Mrs. de Winter and I go to bed tonight, will you come up yourself and lock the door on the outside? And call us yourself at 7 in the morning.
Yes, sir, said Mrs. Danvers. Still she kept her eyes on him, still her hands clutched at her dress.
Very well, then, said Colonel Julian brusquely. I don't think there's anything else we need discuss tonight. I shall be here sharp at 9 in the morning. You will have room for me in your car, De Winter?
Yes, said Maxim.
And Favell will follow us in his. Right on your tail, my dear fellow, right on your tail, said Favell.
Colonel Julian came up to me and took my hand.
Good night, he said. You know how I feel for you in all this. There's no need for me to tell you. Get your husband to bed early if you can. It's going to be a long day.
He held my hand a minute, and then he turned away. It was curious how he avoided my eye. He looked at my chin. Frank held the door for him as he went out. Favell leant forward and filled his case with cigarettes from the box on the table.
I suppose I'm not going to be asked to stop to dinner, he said.
Nobody answered. He lit one of the cigarettes and blew a cloud of smoke into the air.
It means a quiet evening at the pub on the high road, then, he said, and the barmaid has a squint. What a hell of a night I'm going to spend. Never mind, I'm looking forward to tomorrow. Good night, Danny, old lady. Don't forget to turn the key on Mr. de Winter, will you?
He came over to me and held out his hand. Like a foolish child, I put my hands behind my back. He laughed and bowed.
It's just too bad, isn't it, he said. A nasty man like me coming and spoiling all your fun. Don't worry. It will be a great thrill for you when the yellow press gets going with your life story and you see the headlines, from Monte Carlo to Mandalay, Experiences of Murderer's Girl Bride, written across the top. Better luck next time.
He strolled across the room to the door, waving his hand to Maxim by the window.
So long, old man, he said. Pleasant dreams. Make the most of your night behind that locked door.
He turned and laughed at me, and then he went out of the room. Mrs. Danvers followed him. Maxim and I were alone. He went on standing by the window. He did not come to me. Jasper came trotting in from the hall. He had been shut outside all the evening. He came fussing up to me, biting the edge of my skirt. I'm coming up with you in the morning, I said to Maxim. I'm coming up to London with you in the car. He did not answer for a moment. He went on looking out of the window. Then, yes, he said, his voice without expression. Yes, we must go on being together. Frank came back into the room. He stood in the entrance, his hand on the door. They've gone, he said, Favell and Colonel Julian. I watched them go.
All right, Frank, said Maxim.
Is there anything I can do, said Frank, anything at all? Wire to anyone, arrange anything? I'll stay up all night if only there's anything I can do. I'll get that wire off to Baker, of course.
Don't worry, said Maxim. There's nothing for you to do. Yet. There may be plenty, after tomorrow. We can go into all that when the time comes. Tonight we want to be together. You understand, don't you?
Yes, said Frank, yes, of course.
He waited a moment, his hand on the door. Good night, he said. Good night, said Maxim.
When he had gone, and shut the door behind him. Maxim came over to me where I was standing by the fireplace. I held out my arms to him, and he came to me like a child. I put my arms round him and held him. We did not say anything for a long time. I held him and comforted him as though he were Jasper, as though Jasper had hurt himself in some way, and he had come to me to take his pain away.
"We can sit together," he said, driving up in the car.
"Yes," I said.
"Julian won't mind," he said.
"No," I said.
"We shall have tomorrow night, too," he said. "They won't do anything at once, not for 24 hours, perhaps."
"No," I said.
"They aren't so strict now," he said. "They let one see people, and it all takes such a long time. If I can, I shall try and get hold of Hastings. He's the best. Hastings or Burkett. Hastings used to know my father."
"Yes," I said.
"I shall have to tell him the truth," he said. "It makes it easier for them. They know where they are."
"Yes," I said.
The door opened, and Frith came into the room. I pushed Maxim away. I stood up straight and conventional, patting my hair into place.
"Will you be changing, madam, or shall I serve dinner at once?"
"No, Frith, we won't be changing, not tonight," I said.
"Very good, madam," he said.
He left the door open. Robert came in and began drawing the curtains. He arranged the cushions, straightened the sofa, tidied the books and papers on the table. He took away the whiskey and soda and the dirty ashtrays. I had seen him do these things as a ritual every evening I had spent at Manderley. But tonight they seemed to take on a special significance, as though the memory of them would last for ever, and I would say long after, in some other time, "I remember this moment." Then Frith came in and told us that dinner was served. I remember every detail of that evening. I remember the ice-cold consommé in the cups, and the fillets of sole, and the hot shoulder of lamb. I remember the burnt sugar sweet, the sharp savoury that followed. We had new candles in the silver candlesticks. They looked white and slim and very tall. The curtains had been drawn here, too, against the dull grey evening. It seemed strange to be sitting in the dining room and not look out onto the lawns. It was like the beginning of autumn. It was while we were drinking our coffee in the library that the telephone rang. This time it was I who answered it. I heard Beatrice speaking at the other end. "Is that you?" she said. "I've been trying to get through all the evening. Twice it was engaged." "I'm so sorry," I said. "So very sorry. We had the evening papers about 2 hours ago," she said, "and the verdict was a frightful shock to both Giles and myself. What does Maxim say about it?"
"I think it was a shock to everybody," I said. "But, my dear, the thing is preposterous. Why on earth should Rebecca have committed suicide? The most unlikely person in the world. There must have been a blunder somewhere."
"I don't know," I said. "What does Maxim say? Where is he?" she said.
"People have been here," I said. "Colonel Julian and others. Maxim is very tired. We're going up to London tomorrow."
"What on earth for?"
"Something to do with the verdict. I can't very well explain."
"You ought to get it quashed," she said. "It's ridiculous, quite ridiculous, and so bad for Maxim, all this frightful publicity. It's going to reflect on him."
"Yes," I said.
"Surely Colonel Julian can do something," she said. "He's a magistrate. What are magistrates for? Old Horridge from Lanyon must have been off his head. What was her motive supposed to be? It's the most idiotic thing I've ever heard in my life. Someone ought to get hold of Pab. How can he tell whether those holes in the boat were made deliberately or not? Giles said, of course, it must have been the rocks."
"They seem to think not," I said.
"If only I could have been there," she said, "I should have insisted on speaking. No one seems to have made any effort. Is Maxim very upset?"
"He's tired," I said. "More tired than anything else."
"I wish I could come up to London and join you," she said, "but I don't see how I can. Roger has a temperature of 103, poor old boy, and the nurse we've got in is a perfect idiot. He loathes her. I can't possibly leave him."
"Of course not," I said. "You mustn't attempt it.
Whereabouts in London will you be?"
"I don't know," I said. "It's all rather vague."
"Tell Maxim he must try and do something to get that verdict altered. It's so bad for the family. I'm telling everybody here it's absolutely wicked. Rebecca would never have killed herself. She wasn't the type. I've a good mind to write to the coroner myself."
"It's too late," I said. "Much better leave it. It won't do any good."
"The stupidity of it gets my goat," she said. "Giles and I think it much more likely that if those holes weren't done by the rocks, they were done deliberately by some tramp or other, a communist, perhaps. There are heaps of them about. Just the sort of thing a communist would do."
Maxim called to me from the library.
"Can't you get rid of her? What on earth is she talking about?"
"Beatrice," I said desperately, "I'll try and ring you up from London."
"Is it any good my tackling Dick Godolphin?" she said. "He's your MP. I know him very well, much better than Maxim does. He was at Oxford with Giles. Ask Maxim whether he would like me to telephone Dick and see if he can do anything to quash the verdict. Ask Maxim what he thinks of this communist idea."
"It's no use," I said. "It can't do any good. Please, Beatrice, don't try and do anything. It will make it worse, much worse. Rebecca may have had some motive we don't know anything about. And I don't think communists go ramming holes in boats. What would be the use? Please, Beatrice, leave it alone."
Oh, thank God she had not been with us today. Thank God for that, at least. Something was buzzing in the telephone. I heard Beatrice shouting, "Hello? Hello? Don't cut us off. Exchange." And then there was a click and silence. I went back into the library, limp and exhausted. In a few minutes the telephone began ringing again. I did not do anything. I let it ring. I went and sat down at Maxim's feet. It went on ringing. I did not move. Presently it stopped, as though cut suddenly in exasperation. The clock on the mantelpiece struck 10 o'clock. Maxim put his arms round me and lifted me against him. We began to kiss one another, feverishly, desperately, like guilty lovers who have not kissed before. Chapter 26. When I awoke the next morning, just after 6 o'clock, and got up and went to the window, there was a foggy dew upon the grass, like frost, and the trees were shrouded in a white mist. There was a chill in the air, and a little fresh wind, and the cold, quiet smell of autumn. As I knelt by the window, looking down onto the rose garden, where the flowers themselves drooped upon their stalks, the petals brown and dragging after last night's rain, the happenings of the day before seemed remote and unreal. Here at Manderley a new day was starting. The things of the garden were not concerned with our troubles. A blackbird ran across the rose garden to the lawns in swift, short rushes, stopping now and again to stab at the earth with his yellow beak. A thrush, too, went about his business, and two stout little wagtails following one another, and a little cluster of twittering sparrows. A gull poised himself high in the air, silent and alone, and then spread his wings wide and swooped beyond the lawns to the woods and the happy valley. These things continued. Our worries and anxieties had no power to alter them. Soon the gardeners would be astir, brushing the first leaves from the lawns and the paths, raking the gravel in the drive. Pails would clank in the courtyard behind the house. The hose would be turned on the car. The little scullery maid would begin to chatter through the open door to the men in the yard. There would be the crisp, hot smell of bacon. The housemaids would open up the house, throw wide the windows, draw back the curtains. The dogs would crawl from their baskets, yawn and stretch themselves, wander out onto the terrace, and blink at the first struggles of the pale sun coming through the mist. Robert would lay the table for breakfast, bring in those piping scones, the clutch of eggs, the glass dishes of honey, jam and marmalade, the bowl of peaches, the cluster of purple grapes with the bloom upon them still, hot from the greenhouses. Maids sweeping in the morning room, the drawing room, the fresh clean air pouring into the long open windows. Smoke curling from the chimneys, and little by little the autumn mist fading away, and the trees and the banks and the woods taking shape, the glimmer of the sea showing with the sun upon it below the valley, the beacon standing tall and straight upon the headland. The peace of Manderley, the quietude and the grace. Whoever lived within its walls, whatever trouble there was and strife, however much uneasiness and pain, no matter what tears were shed, what sorrows borne, the peace of Manderley could not be broken, or the loveliness destroyed. The flowers that died would bloom again another year, the same birds build their nests, the same trees blossom.
the old quiet moss smell, would linger in the air, and bees would come and crickets and herons build their nests in the deep, dark woods. The butterflies would dance their merry jig across the lawns, and spiders spin foggy webs, and small startled rabbits who had no business to come trespassing poke their faces through the crowded shrubs. There would be lilac and honeysuckle still, and the white magnolia buds unfolding slow and tight beneath the dining-room window. No one would ever hurt Manderley. It would lie always in a hollow like an enchanted thing, guarded by the woods, safe, secure, while the sea broke and ran and came again in the little shingle bays below. Maxim slept on, and I did not wake him. The day ahead of us would be a weary thing, and long. High roads and telegraph poles, and the monotony of passing traffic, the slow crawl into London. We did not know what we should find at the end of our journey. The future was unknown. Somewhere to the north of London lived a man called Baker, who had never heard of us, but he held our future in the hollow of his hand. Soon he, too, would be waking, stretching, yawning, going about the business of his day. I got up and went into the bathroom and began to run my bath. These actions held for me the same significance as Robert and his clearing of the library had the night before. I had done these things before mechanically, but now I was aware, as I dropped my sponge into the water, as I spread my towel on the chair from the hot rail, as I lay back and let the water run over my body. Every moment was a precious thing, having in it the essence of finality. When I went back to the bedroom and began to dress, I heard a soft footstep come and pause outside the door, and the key turn quietly in the lock. There was silence a moment, and then the footsteps went away. It was Mrs. Danvers. She had not forgotten. I had heard the same sound the night before, after we had come up from the library. She had not knocked upon the door. She had not made herself known. There was just the sound of footsteps and the turning of the key in the lock. It brought me to reality and the facing of the immediate future. I finished dressing and went and turned on Maxim's bath. Presently, Clarice came with our tea. I woke Maxim. He stared at me at first like a puzzled child, and then he held out his arms. We drank our tea. He got up and went to his bath, and I began putting things methodically in my suitcase. It might be that we should have to stay in London. I packed the brushes Maxim had given me, a nightdress, my dressing gown, and slippers, and another dress too, and a pair of shoes. My dressing case looked unfamiliar as I dragged it from the back of a wardrobe. It seemed so long since I had used it, and yet it was only 4 months ago. It still had the customs mark upon it they had chalked at Calais. In one of the pockets was a concert ticket from the casino in Monte Carlo. I crumpled it and threw it into the waste-paper basket. It might have belonged to another age, another world. My bedroom began to take on the appearance of all rooms when the owner goes away. The dressing table was bare without my brushes. There was tissue paper lying on the floor and an old label. The beds where we had slept had a terrible emptiness about them. The towels lay crumpled on the bathroom floor. The wardrobe doors gaped open. I put on my hat, so that I should not have to come up again, and I took my bag and my gloves and my suitcase. I glanced round the room to see if there was anything I had forgotten. The mist was breaking. The sun was forcing its way through and throwing patterns on the carpet. When I was halfway down the passage, I had a curious, inexplicable feeling that I must go back and look in my room again. I went without reason, and stood a moment looking at the gaping wardrobe and the empty bed, and the tray of tea upon the table. I stared at them, impressing them forever on my mind, wondering why they had the power to touch me, to sadden me, as though they were children that did not want me to go away. Then I turned and went downstairs to breakfast. It was cold in the dining room, the sun not yet on the windows, and I was grateful for the scalding bitter coffee and heartening bacon. Maxim and I ate in silence. Now and again he glanced at the clock. I heard Robert put the suitcases in the hall with the rug, and presently there was the sound of the car being brought to the door. I went out and stood on the terrace. The rain had cleared the air, and the grass smelt fresh and sweet. When the sun was higher, it would be a lovely day. I thought how we might have wandered in the valley before lunch, and then sat out afterwards under the chestnut tree with books and papers. I closed my eyes a minute, and felt the warmth of the sun on my face and on my hands. I heard Maxim calling to me from the house. I went back, and Frith helped me into my coat. I heard the sound of another car. It was Frank. "Colonel Julian is waiting at the lodge gates," he said. "He did not think it worthwhile to drive up to the house." "No," said Maxim. "I'll stand by in the office all day and wait for you to telephone," said Frank. "After you've seen Baker, you may find you want me up in London." "Yes," said Maxim. "Yes, perhaps." "It's just 9 now," said Frank. "You're up to time. It's going to be fine, too. You should have a good run." "Yes." "I hope you won't get overtired, Mrs. De Winter," he said to me. "It's going to be a long day for you." "I shall be all right," I said. I looked at Jasper, who was standing by my feet, with ears drooping and sad, reproachful eyes. "Take Jasper back with you to the office," I said. "He looks so miserable." "Yes," he said. "Yes, I will."
"We'd better be off," said Maxim. "Old Julian will be getting impatient. All right, Frank."
I climbed in the car beside Maxim. Frank slammed the door. "You will telephone, won't you?" he said.
"Yes, of course," said Maxim.
I looked back at the house. Frith was standing at the top of the steps, and Robert just behind. My eyes filled with tears for no reason. I turned away and groped with my bag on the floor of the car so that nobody should see. Then Maxim started up the car, and we swept round and into the drive, and the house was hidden. We stopped at the lodge gates and picked up Colonel Julian. He got in at the back. He looked doubtful when he saw me.
"It's going to be a long day," he said. "I don't think you should have attempted it. I would have taken care of your husband, you know."
"I wanted to come," I said. He did not say any more about it. He settled himself in the corner.
"It's fine. That's one thing," he said.
"Yes," said Maxim.
"That fellow Favell said he would pick us up at the crossroads. If he's not there, don't attempt to wait. We'd do much better without him. I hope the damned fellow has overslept himself."
When we came to the crossroads, though, I saw the long green body of his car, and my heart sank. I had thought he might not be on time. Favell was sitting at the wheel, hatless, a cigarette in his mouth. He grinned when he saw us, and waved us on. I settled down in my seat for the journey ahead, one hand on Maxim's knee. The hours passed, and the miles were covered. I watched the road ahead in a kind of stupor. Colonel Julian slept at the back from time to time. I turned occasionally and saw his head loll against the cushions and his mouth open. The green car kept close beside us. Sometimes it shot ahead, sometimes it dropped behind. But we never lost it. At 1, we stopped for lunch at one of those inevitable old-fashioned hotels in the main street of a county town. Colonel Julian waded through the whole set lunch, starting with soup and fish, and going on to roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. Maxim and I had cold ham and coffee. I half expected Favell to wander into the dining room and join us, but when we came out to the car again, I saw his car had been drawn up outside a cafe on the opposite side of the road. He must have seen us from the window, for 3 minutes after we had started, he was on our tail again. We came to the suburbs of London about 3 o'clock. It was then that I began to feel tired. The noise and the traffic block started a humming in my head. It was warm in London, too. The streets had that worn, dusty look of August, and the leaves hung listless on dull trees. Our storm must have been local. There had been no rain here. People were walking about in cotton frocks, and the men were hatless. There was a smell of waste paper and orange peel and feet and burnt, dried grass. Buses lumbered slowly, and taxis crawled. I felt as though my coat and skirt were sticking to me, and my stockings pricked my skin.
Colonel Julian sat up and looked out through his window.
"They've had no rain here," he said.
"No," said Maxim.
"Looks as though the place needed it, too."
"Yes,"